perspectives on manifolds. And the first one we saw a couple of lectures ago, was just the gradient, which you can apply, however, only to a scalar field. And it gives a covector. Then mainly we're discussing now the generalization of that, that it will apply not only to scalar fields, but any kind of vector field or tensor field, which is the covariant derivative. And then in a little bit, we'll discuss also the third way of taking derivatives, which is the Lie derivative with respect to a vector field. So this one is the most universal in the sense that it will apply to, it needs, what am I trying to say? I guess I shouldn't say it's the most universal, but it will, it's the most direct generalization of the gradient in the sense that it will give you simultaneously the directional derivatives in all possible directions. Whereas this Lie algebra derivative, Lie derivative will basically give you some generalized directional derivative. It's not even quite a directional derivative. It's more like a derivative along a flow and only in a particular direction, the direction in which the flow is going. So that, however, we won't probably get to today. I don't know. Maybe with luck we will. But for now we're talking about the covariant derivative, which depends in general on a choice of it's there only because we have the metric. But we can take, it takes an arbitrary tensor field and gives you another tensor field with one more covariant index. And it's just some sort of operation that exists on the manifold once you have a metric. In fact, more generally, all you need is what's called a connection. But in all the applications that I can think of, we'd only need to worry about the metric. Actually, there's one application when it comes to defining energy and momentum in relativity and gravity, where it's useful to consider more general connections. So that is more generally more general covariant derivatives, more general objects that satisfy the conditions that we wrote down last time that a covariant derivative satisfies, but that don't necessarily come from a metric. In any of those cases, whether or not it comes from a metric, there's associated, we can define something called the Christoffel symbols. Which we've seen before in the case of a coordinate basis, basically components with respect to a coordinate chart, but it actually can be defined with respect to any basis, and that's very useful because sometimes it's useful to use an orthonormal basis rather than a basis coming from a coordinate chart. So what are the components of the simplest case? The simplest non-trivial case is always a vector. So we want to take the covariant derivative of some vector field. And once we have that, then of course we can get the covariant derivative of a tensor field just by remembering that tensors are products of vectors or covectors. We can get the covector by the fact that if we contract a vector and a covector, we get a scalar. We know the covariant derivative of a scalar. That's really just the ordinary gradient. So that allows you to relate covariant derivatives of vectors to covectors. And once you have both of them, then you can get them from arbitrary tensors for arbitrary tensors. So the question now is, let's take some connection, some covariant derivative. At the moment, we won't even need to use the fact that it came from a metric. Take some covariant derivative and, however, an arbitrary basis, E beta of B, and ask what are the components of this object in the arbitrary basis that'll give us, and we'll see that they'll be just expressed as partial derivatives of the components of V plus correction term involving this thing called the Christoffel symbol, which we've already seen in the case of a coordinate basis. So, So to get the components of this, that just means to contract it with the basis and co-basis elements. So let's start with by contracting it with, instead of both, just it's convenient just to do one at first. Then if we contract also with a contract the A index with a basis vector, then we'll get all the components. So this is a step towards it. Then just do it, I don't think, what do we call this? Not, it's not an integration by parts because we're not integrating. But anyway, if we swap the derivative around, minus where are we? E beta. What's that? I see. I put the index wrong on the end. Okay. Times VB. Okay, that's equal to that. Now this thing, however, is just what this little contraction here is, of course, that's gone. This little contraction here is just the beta component of the vector field V. Now if we can, okay, so that's, so then we have this. So this is just, and then since this is just a scalar, this whole thing that just becomes the gradient of A, gradient sub A of that scalar field, or those four scalar fields, VB, right? Now if we contract, if we go and contract this also with EA, so then we'll get, I go and contract this with EA alpha, on the left-hand side, I'll get now the full component, all in the alpha-beta component of this covariant derivative, so that we call, just by definition, grad alpha V beta. And on the right-hand side, I have to contract this. When I contract this basis alpha's basis vector with the gradient, of course, what I get is always the same thing. It's just the partial derivative in the alpha's direction of V beta. And then here I get just something, which is E alpha, and just leave it there, E alpha, grad alpha, grad A, sorry, E beta, B. And now I'll expand this V B out, so it'll be, I'll use, what do I have to call it, gamma? I guess so. B gamma. Is that what I wanted? Yeah. So here I've introduced the basis vector, so I can get, I can now have everything in terms of the components of the vector field V, right? Okay. So we see that the components in this arbitrary basis of the covariant derivative of V is just equal to the partial derivatives of the components of V in that particular basis, with a correction term, which takes this form, and we call this whole term, which is just algebraic now, we call this gamma, where does everything go? Gamma beta up here, and the A goes, so we put it like this, gamma alpha. So this is the definition of this so-called Christoffel symbol. So it's just the Christoffel symbol applied, contracted with the components of the vector on a particular index. And if you want to see which index it should be, there's a convention here which which is important when the basis is not a coordinate basis. You have to make a convention. Here I've chosen to make the convention that the index that goes with the derivative, which was the, in this case, the alpha, should come second, and then the index that gets saturated by the index of the vector field should come first. So if you take this derivative away, it just looks like a matrix acting on that vector V. Okay? So that's the definition. And this is another notation that's often used for this that makes the order look a little more natural. Is you'll see this a lot, although usually, of course, not with these parentheses, is this. A semicolon is often used to denote covariant derivative. Okay. So either one, these are just different notations for the same thing. If you write it like this, then the order of the indices looks a little more natural. The alpha comes second. Okay, so we have now a formula for gamma. I wonder if I can do this without messing up the index. Probably not, so I'll leave it like this. So this is gamma, beta, alpha. So the main thing is this this definition. I'll just put it in a square. So these are the components. These are the components of the, I don't know if that's the right word, the coefficients that enter into the Christoffel symbol. And they can be regarded in a certain sense as the components of the covariant derivative itself, because they're the things that determine the covariant derivative when you use that basis. It's also convenient to have them in another form. We can also, because if we contract these two basis and cobasis vectors with each other, we get a constant, Kronecker delta. We can put the derivative the other way. And so it's also equal to plus now EA alpha grad A EB gamma times E beta B. Right? So that's an equivalent way of writing it. Both of those are equally valid expressions for the Christoffel symbol. So I remember, maybe I didn't say this. I'm not sure if I said it last time. But it's called a symbol. It's not called the Christoffel tensor because it's not the components of a tensor in any natural sense. Or it's not the components of a tensor in the sense that if you change to another basis, these numbers don't transform the way the components of a tensor would. Rather, and that's really because that's really because the extra information that you need to add to the ordinary derivative to make a covariant derivative, or the extra information that goes into the definition of the covariant derivative, cannot be specified by giving a tensor on the manifold. It's actually something that you might call a second order object. So it's related to some sort of second order tangent space, which I could write like this. So if you want to know what is the Christoffel symbol really, it can be regarded not as a tensor, but as some higher order object. That's something that looks sort of to the next, it looks to the next order in infinitesimals away from the point at which you're defining it. Whereas a tensor is in some sense a first order thing. In any case, this is the formula for it. And now we should ask, suppose that our basis actually does come from a coordinate charge, then we should ask whether or not we get the same gamma. I'm going to not bother with so much with the parentheses now. from the, well, so from the basis E associated to the coordinate charge. Is that the same? Oh, wait. So I didn't say this, right? It implies some gamma from the basis associated with the coordinate charge. And then the question is that the same as the one that we derived earlier? We have derived some similar symbol earlier that came from taking the very, you know, taking the variation of arc length. In other words, from working out the equations of a geodesic, where geodesic is defined in that first sense as the thing that extremizes the arc length. So I claim it is the same. Obviously, we wouldn't be using the same symbol otherwise. And one proof, so you can prove it in many ways. Well, in a second, when we'll define geodesic with respect to this covariant derivative as the straightest curve, we'll see that it has the same meaning. We'll see that the two definitions of geodesic are the same, and therefore the covariant derivative, the Christoffel symbols that enter into the formulas for those geodesics will be the same. But for now, we can do a more prosaic thing. We can just compute what this is in a coordinate basis and notice that it's the same expression. But in order to do that computation, first we have to notice something, which is the symmetry in a coordinate basis of the Christoffel symbol. If you remember when we got it long ago, when we got this Christoffel symbols from the extremization of arc length, we noticed that we might as well define them to be symmetric, because remember, we got the equation d squared x alpha over d tau squared plus gamma alpha beta gamma dx beta d tau dx gamma. I'm just reminding you, this formula we had, that was the geodesic equation that we derived before, when we only had coordinate systems to work with. And so since this is symmetric, there's no point in looking at an anti-symmetric part. So we just define gamma to be anti-symmetric in that case, basically. So now in this case, will it be also symmetric? If it's not, it can't possibly be the same expression. However, it is symmetric. Whoops, sorry, I think I have alpha beta down here, gamma alpha beta. The claim is that it is symmetric because, let's go back to the expression in the box, it involves EA alpha EB beta, and now we have the covariant derivative of E beta B. But remember the formula that we had for E beta B, that was the covariant, that was just the gradient actually of X, the beta's coordinate B, right? This thing was a formula that we derived earlier for the covector, the dual basis vector of the coordinate system, X beta. But then remember that this is symmetric, as we proved, or at least as I asserted earlier. It's part of, so for the covariant derivative, as we've defined it, it's symmetric in what it when it's acting on a scalar, and here it's acting on a scalar. So it's something like saying partial derivatives commute in an inertial, momentarily inertial reference frame. Anyway, this is a true, since it's symmetric, since this is a scalar, Therefore, gamma alpha, this thing is also symmetric. The components of this are symmetric. So therefore, it is symmetric. I mean, I stress it's symmetric when acting on a scalar, just because when it acts on a vector, it's not symmetric, and that's the origin of the Riemann tensor, curvature tensor. But we won't get to for a while. So given that it's symmetric, now I won't go through the proof, but you can do it. We'll get the result in another way in a bit. But if you want to find the explicit expression for the component for the Christoffel symbols in a coordinate basis, so choosing a coordinate chart as we've done, now write the equation, it's one of the general properties we highlighted before. This is called metric compatibility, that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. If you just write that out in the coordinate basis, so then it looks like you write out what that is using this general form here, wherever it is. Well, it's actually not written in a very clean form. So the general statement is, I'm just rewriting what we have above there. So it's equal to partial alpha v beta plus gamma alpha beta gamma v gamma. Right? So just to isolate. So this is the way that the covariant derivative looks in any basis. And now if we write out the right expression, if we write out this statement in a coordinate basis, you can solve for the gammas, and you'll get you'll see that you'll get the same expression as before. So that's one way of doing it. Maybe I should also mention what it looks like for a not a general tensor, because that's sort of obvious. But suppose that now I want some covariant vector, covector, and I want its partial derivative. What I'm going to write now, just it follows trivially from the fact that the gradient of that when you contract a vector with a covector, you get a scalar, and the gradient of the scalar has no correction term. It's just a partial derivative. So therefore, there has to be a minus sign here. There has to be an alpha here corresponding to the partial derivative. Oops, I want the v beta here, of course. Then there has to be, now you have to think, where can it go? It has to contract. In the end, I need a free index beta. So the only place I can find one is here. And I also need something to contract with what's now the dummy index or the bound index on V. And of course, the only one I can find is there. So the only combination I could really write was this, except that I had to remember where to put the alpha and which order to put these two. But aside from that, this is the only combination. And then from this, you can see the rule for the general tensor. You can see the rule. You just take, if you have the covariant derivative of some tensor with a bunch of indices, you just take the partial derivatives of its components and then a correction term for each index. And if the index is a contravariant index, the correction term takes this form. And if it's a covariant index, you get a relative minus sign and it takes this form. Okay, you just contract the things in the way that is the only way you can, if you always make the convention that the index corresponding to the derivative comes last on the Christoffel symbol. Yeah?
On the left side of the board, I'm a bit puzzled as to what gamma A, B, A, B.
I should really put B, C. Or, well, it would have been easier to put nabla C, but Yeah, I mean three independent. Yeah. So if you take that, if you write out that equation and solve for, write that equation using this rule here, and then solve for the gammas using the same technique of symmetrization that we did before, you'll find the formula, and you'll, if you go and compare, you'll see it's the same formula we had before. So there, okay. So in fact, therefore, the gamma old, by which I mean the one that came from this, from the extremization of the arc length, is the same as the gamma nu, by which I mean the one that came from this expression for the components of the covariant derivative, where covariant derivative was defined in the way we've now defined it with respect to a local inertial frame. Okay, any more questions? So now that we have the covariant derivative, we can define geodesic in a second way by saying that a geodesic is a curve whose acceleration is zero. So to do that, we first, of course, want to define the acceleration of a curve, and it'll just be the trivial generalization of the definition that one uses in flat space. So if we define, as usual, if we imagine a curve, and along the curve, its tangent vector, let's say it's a time-like curve for the moment, so it's parameterized by proper time. So u dot u is equal to minus 1. And x is gamma of tau, as usual. Then we define, for the moment, I'm going to define. So the idea is, the underlying idea is you go into one of these momentary inertial frames at the point where you want to define the acceleration, and you just, the space-time looks flat to that order, and you just find the rate of change of u. That gives you the acceleration. So, however, using the technology we have produced so far, I will just take this to be the definition. We can take this, at least for the moment, to be the definition. So it's some sort of covariant derivative along the curve of the velocity vector. And the definition we can give of it is this. Okay. So this can be taken to be the definition of the acceleration along the curve. So what it really means is the acceleration as seen from an inertial frame, a momentarily inertial frame. And we saw, and now we see that the two definitions of, well, I haven't yet defined the other geodesic, but as I said, it's going to be just a curve whose acceleration is zero. And so now we see, since the two, if you write out what this is, you'll see that if you write it out in components, you'll see that it produces this equation, more or less trivially. It takes one line. And so we see that the two definitions of geodesic are in fact the same. So in other words, acceleration old, meaning, because when we talked about the geodesic before, I defined this as I called this an acceleration vector. And now we've defined acceleration this way, so that equals acceleration nu. Now you might think that this looks a little funny, because this, to know, all we're dealing with here is a curve and some tangent vector UA to the curve. And we're talking about its rate of change in the covariant sense along the curve. So we don't have this vector U defined anywhere except on the curve. And yet when we write down this, it looks like we have to define, we have to know what it means to take the derivative of U in any direction. So you'd have to sort of extend U to be some, you'd have to extend it to some field of curves, for example. But it from the physical meaning, this shouldn't depend on anything other than the vector U along the curve, this because it shouldn't depend on anything but the tangent vector to that curve itself. And in fact, so is that true? In fact, you can see it in two ways. You can see, so the claim is that it depends only on U restricted, say, to the curve gamma. This is a notation for the restriction of something. So this right hand, this expression depends only on that. This right hand side of this formula depends only on that, I claim. And how can we see that? So we can see it. We can see it in two ways. So one way is, let's go into an inertial frame. Let's go into a coordinate frame, which is an inertial frame. So in the inertial frame, this local inertial frame that we always refer to, in that thing, the covariant derivative is just the partial derivative. So within that frame, this just looks like the vector v dotted into the partial derivative. It's just the directional derivative of u a or u alpha along the direction of u. But to know that, you only need to know u, restricted to the curve. So that's one way of seeing it. The other way of seeing it is more calculational. When you make arguments like that, you always feel, well, it feels true, but is it really true? Maybe if I check it in some way involving a calculation, I'll have more faith in it. So that you can also do it here. So this is now true in an arbitrary frame. It doesn't even need to be a coordinate chart. In an arbitrary choice of basis vectors, this is true. And again, you see that it depends only on the direction. If we dot this into U A, U alpha here it's a beta, but if we dot this into U, then it's only the directional derivative of the components along the U direction, plus a correction that's purely algebraic, that doesn't involve derivatives of V at all, of the components of V. Okay, so either way, have I written it out? So this is the proof of that claim. Or it's from, let's give this formula a name, or it's from this formula. So either way, you see that this, although it looks a little peculiar, in fact, it doesn't involve having to know the value of the tangent vector where it's not defined. Okay. It's also true. The deeper reason why this happens is that both the definition of this and, in fact, the definition of this too, in other words, the definition of covariant derivative along a curve and of covariant derivative in general, really they involve what's called parallel transport along a curve. That's the underlying thought. So in a little bit, I'll actually just define parallel transport, because we won't actually... you can always get by with things like you don't ever really have to talk about parallel transport for doing calculations, I think, but the underlying idea is very important. It's the analog of, like in the gauge theory, a holonomy where you the phases that accumulate along a curve in a gauge theory, or the non-abelian operation, sort of that you write down this, what's it called, path-ordered product, if you're familiar with those things. This is the exact same idea for gravity, so it's probably worth talking about it, making it a little more definite. But first, so we'll do that in a second, but first, let's go back to let's finish talking about the second definition of geodesic. So before we had geodesic as longest curve, at least in the time-like curve, now we're going to talk about geodesic as straightest curve. So that's the second definition of geodesic. Of course, we'll see that they're the same, fortunately, in curved space, just as they are in flat space. So we call a curve geodesic. So this is the definition now. If and only if the acceleration is zero, where we've just defined the acceleration this way, okay? I.e., if and only if, let me not write it down for a second. Now, one advantage of having this definition is that it works as well for not only for time-like curves, but also for light-like curves. It's probably not that important physically, although sometimes it's very useful to have a notion of geodesic if a space-like curve, but it's absolutely crucial to have a notion of geodesic for a null curve, because those are in the approximation of point photons. Those are the curves followed by light, or in geometrical optics. Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure. When you say a geodesic is the longest time, I don't think I have an intuition for that. I don't see why it's not
short. Oh, that's because you're still thinking in Euclidean, in a three-dimensional way and not in a four-dimensional way. So the question is of course, mathematically it just comes from the minus dt squared plus sort of dx dot dx. In flat, and if we go back to Minkowski space, we have this formula. And this is, it's this minus sign, of course, that's causing the difficulty. Now, but there are many ways to get intuition why it should not be the shortest curve. Because the shortest curve will always, see, if I take two events, which are time-like related, so that they can be connected by a time-like curve, what would be the shortest curve I could draw between here and here? What? No, I mean to make the arc length be as defined by this to be as short as possible. Mm-hmm. So think of the twin paradox. Mm-hmm. So the length is the proper time, if along some curve, is really the elapsed proper time on a watch or a clock that this thing carries with. As you know from the twin paradox, if something goes off at high speed and comes back, the elapsed time is less, not more.
Yeah.
And so in particular, yeah, if we actually could imagine going out at the speed of light then and coming back, there would be zero elapsed time. So there's no lower bounds. If you ask for the shortest curve, you'll always get something crazy like this. And basically, you'll get zero. I mean, you could go like this, anything zigzag. As long as it's basically always going at or as close as it can to the speed of light, you can get as short a length as you want. So that's a sort of indication why we shouldn't be surprised that it's going to be the longest curve.
If you were to fix a velocity at like half the speed of light, would there be some? The longer the time, the further the distance might be. Is there like a balance between balancing dx, making that bigger, and then?
I'd say if we said that this object could not go faster than half the speed of light.
Then
the shortest curve would be to go at half the speed of light, mm-hmm. like this, and then come back at half the speed of light.
Okay.
That would be as short as you could make it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And in general, there won't even be a single shortest curve, right? Because anything that's basic, anything that runs around in any way at near the speed of light will have zero elapsed time. Mm-hmm. So you'll get nothing useful by demanding the shortest curve. But by demanding the longest curve, you get, in general, unless there's focusing, some generically you'll get a unique curve between those two. Okay. And there'll always be some longest curve. Mm-hmm. The only other thing I can, yeah. I was going to say something else to try and add to the intuition. Afterwards, after I do this, you know. Okay. So it's also this. Sometimes I've heard it once called the law of cosmic laziness, which is that left to its own devices. In other words, if you exert no forces on this object, it'll take the longest time it can to get from here to here. we can relate this to the redshift in an interesting way. So remember. What the redshift tells us is that, so don't ask me rigorously what I mean by any of these things, but we can actually turn this into sort of Fermat's principle. If I have time, I'll show you. But anyway, we've seen that in a certain sense, clocks run slower down here and they run faster up here, right? So if you make some fixed comparison. So now, suppose I take, these are events, right? So suppose I take this object and I say it wants to go between two events in the laziest possible way. It wants to accumulate the longest time that it can in getting between these two events. And here's the two events. Right? So how should it do that? Well, it wants the longest time to accrue. I think that's what I was looking to accumulate. So if it just sits here, well, whatever that time is. On the other hand, if it can go up here, its clock runs faster. So, it can accumulate more time. On the other hand, to get here, it has to go there, and that makes that by the what's it called by the Lorentz contraction, or what is the time dilation. By that, it'll lose time, right? I mean, its clock will run slower while it's running up here. So it has to make some sort of compromise between getting up here to accumulate time more rapidly and not going too fast, not running too fast so that it will slow down its clock. So how would you do it? If you think about it, well, I would go up here about as fast as I could, hang for a while here, and then before it's too late, come back in order to make my appointment, right? So it'd be... Right. So that's actually what it does, right? It goes up rather rapidly, it hangs here for a while, and then it comes back down. So it's just being lazy when it does that. So that, I mean, that doesn't really answer, it just brings in another facet of the question. So it allows you to tie together two things. So if you remember that clocks run faster up here, and you know how things move, then you can sort of see that it's trying to lengthen its geodesic, its curve as much as possible. Okay. Yeah. The other question.
So you said that generically there's a unique curve which is at the longest time.
Right.
Is there also a similar statement that you made about space like curve?
Oh, good question. No. The answer is no. So generically, so space like, see, just because for this same reason, a space-like curve can never be anything but a saddle point. It can never be either a shortest or a longest. See, if I take a space-like curve, like say in this table, this is time running. Well, if I were to get between here and here, I can obviously make it as long as possible. It has nothing to do with relativity. It's just ordinary plane geometry. So here's a curve. Okay, that's a very long curve. It gets from here to here. So you'll never get a longest curve between here and here. But because of the Lorentzian signature, you'll never get a shortest curve either. If you demand to stay in this table, then there will be a shortest curve, of course, which is the straight line. But as soon as we can go out of the table, we can use the same trick. So here's two space-like separated points. Let me go like this. That's a curve which is null everywhere. So it's a blank zero. So there's always a curve of length zero, and there's always a curve of arbitrarily long length if we limit ourselves to space-like curves. This is not strictly space-like, but anyway, I can make space-like curves of a length as small as I like and as large as I like. So it will only be, so in Minkowski space, of course, there is still a geodesic unique that goes between them, but it will always be a saddle point. If I wiggle it in one way, I'll make it shorter, and if I wiggle it in the other way, I'll make it longer.
So if we restrict ourselves to geodesics, then there is an extremized one, but it's a saddle point.
That's right.
There's only one extremized curve connecting two
points? No, in general, there can be more than one. Even for the time-like case, there can, in general, be more than one. So here's an example from, I can't pitch that fast that I can illustrate it, but if I could throw fast enough, right, I could make a, I could make a satellite orbit. I could throw something fast enough so that it would go around the Earth and come back here. So that's a geodesic. It takes a certain time, whatever, it may be an hour or something, to come back. But I can also do what I just did before. I could throw it up far enough so that it came back in exactly the same time. So those are two different time-like, so here's the Earth or something. Here's two different time-like geodesics that both go between the same two-point events in space-time. Right? They both depart at the same time, and they both arrive at the same time. But in between, they're doing something very different. So that's just an illustration of... So that's what's called focusing sometimes, or I don't know exactly, I think... In generic way, it's called, and this will happen generically when there's curvature. And there's, of course, curvature around the surface of the Earth.
And the elapsed time will be different?
And the elapsed time will, in general, in this case, it will be different. I don't see any reason why it should be the same. When they're infinitesimally nearby, that's, it forms what's called a caustic, and then they are the same to first order. But what you can say is not that, what you can say is that if you take these two curves and then they come back together and cross, and then they go a little bit farther, I mean, you just extend them both a little bit farther, one of them will cease to be a longest curve, even if they were both longest curve. In this case, I suspect one of them is already shorter than the other, but even if they were both longest curves, as soon as you... This is very important in the proof of the singularity theorem and the positive and certain proofs of the positive energy theorem. So think of these as two infinitesimally nearby curves, sort of gamma and gamma prime, and they cross here. That's called focusing. And such a point is called a caustic, and it's called a caustic because this is what happens. You know, the figures you get in light when you see caustics on the windowsill or something, a window or whatever. I don't know. When some light goes through a lens and you see, it's called a caustic. That's what it is. But these are now time-like. These are now, in that case, null curves, light-like curves. But anyway, after they cross, before they cross, it could be that each of these are geodesics in the sense of being the longest, absolute longest curve between those two events, point events. But once they cross, one of them cannot be. At least one of them has to fail to be the longest curve. So they'll now be a shorter curve, say like that, that goes from here to here. And what that means is that, I'm probably saying too much on this, but it's kind of an interesting thing. What it means is that the light cone emanating from this point formed a fold, sort of crossed over itself. So you get a picture like this. These are, I don't know if that's clear what that's supposed to be. Something like, this is that event where they crossed, and then this is, then I suppose I should make these dotted. They're going inside, I'm drawing the future of this point P and the boundary of the future. It's this light cone, and they're, once, in, well, I didn't, what I didn't draw was the two curves, so the one, the two curves the gamma and gamma prime are going like this. Like that, or here. This place where they cross, trace out this caustic here. And I don't think the picture is too comprehensible, but the point is that the light cone ceases to be topologically. The locus of all the light rays ceases to be topologically a cone, and only the outer boundary of it is really what you might call the light cone in the causal sense of the word, and it acquires this kink here, this little, which is a caustic. I'm not sure if this is called a caustic, actually. There's some terminological thing that I never can get straight. I think the caustic might be only where they cross and inside where there's another sharp edge here that you can sort of hear and here, the locus of these points. That turns out to be a key thing in proofs of the singularity theorem. So in any case, we want to talk about, we've defined geodesic, and now we want to this is useful because it allows us to talk about light-like geodesics as well as time-like geodesics. However, there's a subtlety, which it depends on the parameterization. So when we talked about the time-like geodesic, we derived, if you remember long ago, we derived the geodesic equation, and we saw that it took a simple form only when we used proper time as the parameter. We'll again, now that we have this definition of, now we have the covariant derivative, we'll again be able to derive the geodesic equation by varying this arc length. It'll be the same equation, but the derivation will be more intrinsic. We won't have to use coordinate system to do the derivation, but it will still be important that the geodesic equation will then just take this form here, but it'll still be important to get a simple form that we use arc length. However, when you talk about a light-like geodesic, then of course arc length is zero, so you can't use that. So how do you parameterize it? So in order to define a geodesic, we actually have to, if we want to use an equation like that, we have to limit ourselves to special kinds of parameters called affine parameters. So now I'm going to, when I say the acceleration is zero, that's a bit of a fake because the acceleration is zero if the parameter is chosen appropriately, right? Lambda is what I'm going to use to parameterize the curve. So let's consider the same setup we always have, the notation that we always have. So it's a curve mapping lambda to gamma of lambda, which is a point in the manifold. And now we say, so if the by d lambda of d gamma of lambda d lambda, remember this just means the tangent vector, that's what I called u before, if that equals zero, then gamma is geodesic and lambda is what's called an affine parameter. With this definition, so this is the actual definition of a geodesic. So if you like, a geodesic is a curve that can be parameterized in such a way that this equation holds. In the case of the time-like curve, we didn't have to say that because we could have just said use arc length. And in the case of the space-like curve, we could have said the same thing. just use arc lengths. But in the case of the light-light curve, we have to be a little careful. Now, clearly, I don't know why I wrote. So clearly, lambda, if lambda is an affine parameter, then so is any linear multiple. So anything of the form A lambda plus B is also an affine parameter. Right? Because if I shift the zero of lambda, that's not going to affect this equation. And if I multiply, if I rescale lambda by some constant, that'll just bring out that constant here squared, and it won't affect, since the right-hand side is zero, it won't affect it. So it's clear that in the null case, I will have an ambiguity in how to choose the affine parameter. Okay. However, I do need to have an affine parameter. So now that I've defined geodesic, I have to do a little bit more work to claim that the geodesic defined in this way is the same as the geodesic defined in the other way, because in the other way, I use proper time, and here I've said affine parameter. So we have to check whether or not affine parameter, whether proper time is an affine parameter. So I claim it is. Tau is an affine parameter if the curve is time-like. You could say here space-like too, but really just as long as it's not light-like, then lambda is an affine parameter. So how do we prove that? So let's write just a variety of notation, I suppose. I'll just use dots. Okay, so that's my U that I called it before. So then if D X dot A, this was the geodesic equation, right? D lambda, so different, I'm just representing differentiation by lambda with a dot here. So this is, if it's a geodesic, then this is true. But that means that if I form d by d lambda of GAB x dot A x dot B, what'll I get? So first of all, go back to the definition of this covariant derivative along a curve. So it just involves the covariant derivative. So the covariant derivative of G is zero, so that'll pass through, and so that'll just be zero plus, if I write it out explicitly, it'll be X dot C grad C GAB times X dot, which is zero, and then I'll get twice GAB X dot A because of the symmetry D by D lambda X dot B, right? And that, so this is zero. And of course, this is zero because I just assumed that we're dealing with a geodesic. So it's equal to zero. That's zero also. So in other words, the length of the tangent vector, if I've used an affine parameter, then the length of the tangent vector is conserved along the geodesic. Now in the time-like case, so this was general. Now let's take, this is always true for any geodesic. So notice incidentally, it means that if the geodesic starts null, meaning that this would be zero, it's going in a time-like direction, a light-like direction, then it'll always remain null. So you can't have geodesics that sort of switch over from being light-like to being space-like or being time-like or something. Once it's time-like, it's always time-like. So that's one. So therefore, time-like remains time-like. That's one consequence. Null or light-like remains null, and so on, space-like. That's one conclusion we can draw. The other thing is, now let's look at the time-like case. Then this, what is this GAB? This GAB, this is just G, this GAB x dot A x dot B is just GAB dx A dx B over d lambda squared. That's its definition, right? We said that that equals a constant. I'll just call it C squared, maybe. Call it C squared. Since it's time-like, it's probably best to call it negative C squared. Of course, this doesn't mean the speed of light. It's just some constant. And so that means that G, and the numerator here is d tau squared. So it says that d minus d tau squared, which is the numerator, is equal to minus C squared d lambda squared. So in other words, d tau is equal to C d lambda. It's a linear multiple of lambda. So that means that d tau is C d lambda, and that means that tau is equal to C lambda plus B, or something like some possible constant. So we said, by definition, lambda was an affine parameter. Therefore, since in the time-like case, this equation holds, therefore tau is an affine parameter. Okay, so the conclusion is that tau is always, if the curve is a geodesic, tau is also an affine parameter. So therefore, I could, I'm thinking, did I really have to say that? Maybe I didn't really have to say that, because this equation, I think I did have to say, I think I did have to. Okay, so in any case, tau is an affine parameter, so in the time-like case, our definition, we could write that the acceleration is zero using tau, which is actually what I did here. So in other words, this definition that I've given for geodesic in general, if I specialize it to the time-like case, says that it's geodesic if and only if this A is zero, because tau will be an affine parameter then. So the last thing, any questions on that? So the last thing is to, let's write down the geodesic equation in a coordinate chart. I've already done that actually, so I don't think I need to write it down. It's already there. So this, you just have to observe, I want to observe that this really is the geodesic equation that we had over there in a coordinate chart. That's a pretty trivial check. So now let's take the coordinate chart again. In a coordinate chart, remember that dx, an infinitesimal displacement, goes over its coordinates is gotten by contracting it with a basis vector, and that equals, by definition, dx alpha in the coordinate chart. Remember, and I'm being sloppy now, I'm using x for two different things, the point of the manifold and then here for the name of the coordinate. Therefore, dx, when I write d by d lambda, dx d lambda, A, that'll go over, and its components will be using this. I guess I call this UA, so it'll be D by. I'll call this UA anyway. So maybe I called it X dot of A. I called it X dot of A. I think I called it both, but I'll call it X dot now. So it'll be dx dot, so this is just some vector field, dx dot of A, its component, d lambda, plus, I'm just using this formula, that formula up there for the covariant. Oops. Where is the formula? Oh, sorry, I've left out a step. I have to put here, it's x dot of A, x dot B. So this is equal to this. It's x dot B times grad V x dot A, right? And now its components are, so this will become x dot beta. Now I have to multiply, now I have to take the covariant derivative of this. So x, I should have said here, because of this, x dot, the components of x dot A, of course, are dx alpha d lambda. So I have to put in here, I have to put I have to put the partial derivative beta in the beta direction of x dot alpha plus gamma alpha beta lambda, sigma, x dot sigma, right? Okay, so I've just substituted into that general formula that we had. And then this, so x dot beta dotted into partial beta, that just means the derivative along the direction. I mean, this is, I should substitute what this is. This is dx beta d lambda. So this just says partial x dot alpha partial x beta d lambda, so it's just d by d, this whole first term is just d by d lambda of x dot alpha, and x dot alpha is just dx alpha d lambda. And then I have here gamma alpha, I called it sigma beta d lambda dx sigma d lambda, finally. So those are the components. I think I called this the acceleration, a sub a. So these are the components of the components alpha of the acceleration vector. So that derives. So the form of the geodesic equation in particular is then that this should vanish, which was, of course, exactly the form of the equation that we had before. So they're definitely the same. And the reason, of course, the underlying reason that they're the same is that they're both saying the same thing. To say, they're both saying that in a momentarily inertial reference frame, this curve gamma is a straight line. It's not curving at that point. Okay, any questions on that? More questions, yeah.
How did you kill a portion?
Oh, I just, just by, I, well, well, no. I mean, depends. If we were just talking in a very general way about covariant derivatives and connections, then it's by assumption. We require zero torsion. On the other hand, the way we actually define covariant derivative in a certain way. We said, basically, take the manifold and take take a point in the manifold P, and then take a portion of Minkowski space and find a neighborhood between a mapping of charts, let's say C between, but this is now Minkowski space, such that lengths agree to higher, to second order and not just to first order. That's, this was a momentarily, what I was calling a momentarily inertial frame. At that point, they agreed to second order, that special point. And then we said that covariant derivative should be essentially given by just ordinary derivative in such a, in any such chart. In other words, we use the equivalence principle. So that thing actually, that definition led to zero torsion because it meant that the, that's going to be a homework problem, I think. So I better, it's probably not a, yeah. So, but the claim is that when you trace through the definition, that you'll see that the torsion is zero. Yeah. So that's why you can't remember when we actually proved it. Because I think I just stated that the definition implies it, and I was planning to do it as a homework. If I don't give it as a homework, then we'll have to, then remind me and we'll come back and actually do the proof. So now I wanted to say a few words before we go on to the Lie derivative, which is crucial in talking about conservation laws and symmetries, and also about gauge invariance for gravitational waves and so on, because the Lie derivative is it really means an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. But before we talk about that, I wanted to say a few things about parallel transport, which is the idea underlying this covariant derivative. So when we go back to this picture, we're in Minkowski space and we have a notion of parallelism in Minkowski space. It's just flat, a vector space. So given a vector at this point, if I blow this up, given a vector here, some vector v at some point, and some neighboring point here, I can talk about moving that vector without change from this point to the neighboring point. Right? In flat space, I can move it anywhere I like. So it turns out to first order, I can move it. It makes sense even in the curved space. So this using the parallel notion of parallel in flat space can be transferred back using these momentarily inertial frames, transferred back to the space-time itself. And so it makes sense to move locally, to move a thing parallel to itself without change in length. Just like we're familiar on the surface of the Earth, right? You can move things. If this is the Earth and you take something to represent a vector, I don't know, a hockey stick or something, and you move it, and I walk along, I move it always parallel, I always keep parallel to itself. That's a special two-dimensional case of no matter how I'm walking, I always keep it parallel to itself, right? That's a special case of parallel transport in two dimensions. That's also where the idea of curvature comes from, which is the sort of gravitational analog of the gauge field, FAV, coming from the vector potential, AV. Just to remind you of this, how it works, so on the Earth, suppose I took something pointing in this direction and I walk along parallel from the North Pole down to the equator, of course, it'll be pointing now. It's always been pointing south, and it'll continue to point south when I reach the equator. Then I walk along the equator, let's say, so it's still pointing south. It's always, so as I walk along the equator, it still remains like this, it's pointing south. And then I walk north, back to the North Pole, well, it's still pointing south, but of course, it's a different south now. If I look down on the North Pole, what's happened is I started like this, I went off, walked around, came back, and now it's pointing, say, like this. So that's the non-integrability of this parallel transport, as it's called. So in a neighborhood of a point, if you parallel transport things around, they come back to themselves. But if you go a finite distance away, it doesn't necessarily come back to itself. So that's how curvature is actually defined in the case of space-time. The Riemann tensor gives you the infinite, gives you sort of a local handle on what the curvature is. But the idea underlying the definition of curvature is precisely this notion of parallel transport. I mean, to tell the story, I had to say I walk along moving this thing parallel to itself. So the question is, what is that? How do we make that notion more, a little bit more definite, more precise? And then, well, let me imagine a curve. It's always parallel transport along a particular curve, right? So let me imagine a particular curve, gamma, and say that I have a vector at some point and I want to transport it to another point. So let this be gamma, let this first point be gamma of lambda, let this second point be gamma of mu, just two different values of the parameter. I'm going to introduce what's called a bitensor now. So it's a tensor field that has one index living here and one index living here. That's going to let me map vectors from this point, for example, to vectors at this point. Of course, once I can do it for vectors, I can do it for covectors and everything, because parallel transport is going to preserve the metric. So between using the metric, I can go between. It's going to preserve length. So using the metric, I can go between vectors and covectors. So anyway, so the essential task is to transport a vector from one point to another. It's called parallel, but that's really, it means more than parallel, right? It means preserving everything, length as well as direction. So I'm going to introduce this tensor. So this is a tensor, but its indices live in different spaces. This A index lives in the tangent space at mu of lambda to the manifold, whereas this B index lives in, actually in this case, it's the cotangent space of, not mu of lambda, sorry, gamma of lambda, and this is gamma of mu to the manifold. So this is just a linear map from vectors here to vectors here. So sigma, therefore the sigma, I won't write all its indices again, it maps it maps the tangent space at gamma of mu to the tangent space at gamma of lambda. Now, once we can do, suppose we know how to do that. I claim, if you think about it, it's hard to say this clearly in words, but if you think about it, being able to do this is the same thing as being able to form derivatives. Because if we can form derivatives, and that's what we basically did here, if you can form derivatives, then you can say that the parallel transport is just one in which the derivative is zero everywhere along the curve. So, in fact, what we said when we said that we had a geodesic is that the tangent vector is parallel transported along the geodesic curve. And conversely, if you know how to parallel transport, then you can form derivatives by the following thing. And why do you need something special to form derivatives? Well, because you can't compare vectors here and here. But once you have parallel transport, you can, and you can use that to form derivatives. And so here's the definition. So here's a second definition of this same covariant derivative along a curve. It's d by, I'll write it down and then I'll say what it means. It's important to put the explicit dependent on the parameter lambda. At lambda equals zero. Here I have assumed that V is in any vector field, but I've assumed that it lives in the right place. In other words, when I say V of lambda, that of course must belong to the appropriate tangent space, V which is the tangent space to the manifold at the point parameterized by lambda along the curve. And what did I want to, something else. And of course I've assumed, I mean, what I'm doing is computing the value of this covariant derivative at the point lambda equals zero, at some particular point, which I've taken to be zero. So here I've taken this, here I'll get rid of these other, this other thing now. I'll just take this to be lambda equals zero. And then this other point, the sort of moving point, so to speak, just to be some lambda. So what I've done is I've, in order to compare the vectors, I've pulled them all back to a fixed tangent space, and then I've computed the rate of change in that tangent space. And that'll be, and then that fixed one will be the one at which I will get this covariant derivative. Yeah.
A small thing, are you missing a b there? 3 sigma a 0 lambda b?
Yes, this should have an a.
I mean, in the equation.
This should definitely, sorry, yeah, thanks.
And
right.
Also, having the lambda and the mu between the a and the b, does that mean that the contravariant indices depend on lambda and mu and the covariant doesn't?
No, they both do. So the b belongs to mu, and the a belongs to lambda. If I write it, I think I wrote it correctly.
Okay. Yeah, it was just strange to see it in the middle of the indices.
Oh, I see. Why did I not just write it like this? Yeah. So the idea is to show that the association between b and mu and a and lambda. You're saying why didn't I write it like this?
Yeah.
That would be equally good. I mean, that would be an equally valid notation. But this is a little more mnemonic. That's all. This doesn't have, I mean, it's just a notation. It doesn't, it's not implying anything extra. Okay, so now if V is in fact parallel transported, then we want this to be zero. So what is that? What do I want to say? So if V were parallel transported, we saw that I want to define this in such a way that it's equivalent to the definition that we gave before. So then if V is parallel transported along the curve, then we want that gamma dot A, gradient A, V, B equals zero. What's more, again, what does this mean? It means that in a momentarily inertial coordinate chart, the components of V don't change, or V, the vector that in the chart space that represents V is actually not changing along the curve to first order. In fact, we want, this is just if it's parallel transport. More generally, if it's not parallel transported, we would like this. So if not, so in general, we still want this to give, it won't be zero, but we want it to give the rate of change. So we want it to be this expression, dVa d lambda, right? So we can take this, we can actually just take this as a formula to define, this is now a condition on this sigma, right? It has to give this result if we define this dV lambda, if we define the parallel, the covariant derivative along the curve in this way, coming from parallel transport, then we want this equation to hold. So then how does parallel transport look in a coordinate chart? Okay. Is it clear? I always feel it's confusing to my, even when I think about it, I always feel confused a little bit at this point. But I think it's correct what I said? Does it seem clear? Okay, so given that, what is it telling us about this sigma? This would have been called, or it probably is called actually, a holonomy operator. This is certainly in the context of gauge theories, it's called holonomy, and this could be, or this also is in the same context as a tangent bundle and so on. So this is the Christoffel symbol, or the covariant derivative operator, is called a connection, and this is called the holonomy of the connection, which we have to give a name. So we can either call it gamma, or we can call it covariant derivatives. They're equivalent things. So either one is a reasonable name for the connection. Sometimes holonomy is limited to the case where the curve is closed, but it's also used more generally in which it's not necessarily closed. So this the fact that we want the holonomy to have this property, that's defining it, because it's telling us, that's enough, because it's telling us how to parallel transport infinitesimally, and once you have that, then by integrating it up, you can get it in general. Although there's no simple formula you can write for it, unfortunately, other than this implicit definition of it. So anyway, so how does it look? Now, just one last thing. How does it look in a, or let me draw a picture actually here to see what's going on. So we have a point at the manifold. We have a vector dxa, so a point x, let's say. We have dxa along which we wish to parallel transport a vector. And here's the vector that we wish to parallel transport. So that's v of x. Let's call it a vector. So it's va of x. And then after parallel transport, it becomes some other vector. And this is va of x plus dx. And we got there by this parallel transport. So what is it? So if it's parallel transported, then we know that 0 is equal to dVa d lambda, the covariant derivative along the curve, which we just defined to be dxb d lambda times covariant derivative grad sub v of a, I guess. And what we do, I just don't need to repeat the whole calculation. We just had it up there somewhere. So that's if and only if 0 is equal to dv alpha d lambda plus gamma alpha, what should I call it? Gamma beta dv gamma d lambda. Okay, this is just that dv being contracted with the gamma, and then there's the index that comes from the, I'm contracting this tangent vector with the index here that corresponds to the derivative. So that's d x beta I don't know what I did here. There's no, I'm just taking the covariant derivative of V, not, so this should be just V gamma. So I'm just trying to take gradient of covariant derivative of V, so I get a V here, okay. And now if I divide through, if I just erase the lambdas, D lambdas, then it gives us rule for the change in the components of V, which is alpha gamma beta V gamma dx beta. So this is the rule for parallel transport in components. It's telling you that the change of the components, if we're in an inertial frame momentarily in which gamma is zero, then it just tells you the components do not change. If we're not in an inertial frame, it's telling you that they change by an amount proportional to dx, and in a way that acts linearly on the components of the vector v. Okay, so that's equivalent to this formula is really equivalent to our definition of covariant derivative, because again, remember, if we know how to parallel transport, we can take derivatives and vice versa. So you can think of this as just a different form, a different way of expressing the same thing in a formula that the covariant derivative expresses. And if we ask what it's telling us about this polynomial operator itself, it's telling us to transform just from x plus dx, remember the holonomy operator went backwards the other way. So we'll get a relative minus sign. It takes you from the point x plus dx back to the point x, the way I've written it. So to the first order, it doesn't do anything, of course. It's just delta alpha beta. But this is telling us the change, the small correction, which is this dv alpha, is then just given by dx gamma, I guess. Why have I changed? Alpha beta gamma. Okay. I think I swapped two indices around here. Anyway, this is, they're all free index indices, so gamma is a dummy. Anyway. Yeah, I think I swapped beta and gamma in writing these two things down. But in other words, this is saying, what do I have to apply to V in order to get the correction? So this is pulling you back from x plus dx to x. And in components, this is how you have, this is what you do. So anyway, they both tell you the same thing, which is that these components of the Christoffel, that these numbers that constitute the Christoffel symbol, they're the expression in the coordinate chart of parallel transport. So here you see it very, here and here you see it very explicitly. I think that's all. Oh, I wanted to mention that parallel transport also preserves length. So what? Oh, okay. And that's simple also. So under parallel transport, we have dxa grad a vb. If we're parallel transporting the vector b along dx, then it means, by as we've seen, that just by definition that this is zero. That implies that dxa grad a. Now I can throw in, I put a second b. I mean, so far this is still equal to zero. Because it's zero when it acts both on either of the, I mean, this v and that v, of course, it's zero. And also, remember that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero, the so-called metric compatibility. So I can throw in here a GBC also. And then what I've learned is that the change in the length of v is zero. So it preserves length, since what I've used here is the ubiquitous, I seem to like it. I did the same thing. I started to write grade A, G, A, B equals zero. Using that, this follows. And therefore, it preserves length. And by the same argument, if I put in here two distinct vectors instead of the same one, it'll preserve angles as well. basically, it just preserves the metric. Therefore, it preserves everything that comes from the metric, including lengths and angles. Okay, so that's the idea. That I guess there's no point. It's too late to start on Lie derivatives, so we'll start on that next time. Yeah?
So if you apply this sigma onto B beta, I guess.
Okay.
You get the right hand side, but how do you get this different root B alpha?
Which formula are we looking at this here?
The formula for sigma.
Oh, okay. If we apply this to beta, let this act on V beta. Okay. So let it act on, this is all in a coordinate system or at least some sort of basis so that we have components. So this will give, I'll just get V alpha. And then I'll get plus dx gamma. Red alpha, beta, gamma, V, gamma. Oh, do I have a, oh, I wonder if, V beta. No, this is right. So this should be the same. The only problem is that I switched beta and gamma here. But if I swap beta and gamma, then this is the same. And since they're both demi indices, it doesn't matter whether or not. You know how I write them.
Okay, I just misinterpreted what you said. So you hit it with the beta and reproduce the
You do reproduce this equation. The only difference is actually I meant to stress that I didn't say that I didn't, which is this is sort of forward transport instead of in other words, this is the formula for pushing V from X to X plus DX, right? Because we got this by demanding that as you move along in the forward direction that the covariant derivative be zero. I mean, this is the covariant derivative in the forward direction. So this tells you how to change the components if you want to push it forward. But the way I had defined this, it was going backward. Okay, that's the reason I did it that way, of course, is that I wanted to have a fixed point at which to evaluate the rate of change of this parallel transported V. So if I think of the curve as going forward, I need to pull it back. I mean, if you think of it's just a trivial sign, really, but if you think about it, there was a rationale for doing it in this way. It wasn't just to confuse everyone that I introduced the minus sign. Yeah.
So is dV alpha the new vector at the new position? The same vector at the new position, or?
Is which? This is the change.
That's the change in the vector.
That's the change in the vector. It's not the change in the vector, because that doesn't have meaning. It's the change in the coordinate, the components of the vector,
okay,
in this chart.
Okay. So could you write down explicitly what the new vector looks like?
Here it is. It's this. In some sense, the change in the vector is zero. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
This is as near as we can come in a curve space to saying that the vector hasn't changed.
Yeah. Okay.
But in any given choice of basis, its components do have to change in order that the vector not change, so to speak.
Okay.
Question. Oh, of course, you're always welcome to do. Yeah, maybe. Do you want me to reinstate it for the next homework?